Over the years, since the beginning of Ananda, which manifests now as this temple and teaching center and school and all these things, but began as a rural community and division by Swami Kriyananda, the founder of what Master had in mind and what was possible in this age for spiritual people. Swamiji has never worked on a theoretical basis. It's one thing to have a vision of what's possible. It's quite another to sort of, just write out all these ideas about how things are going to be, rather than, as Swami himself said, responding to the opportunities that are in tune with what you're trying to accomplish. Yogananda himself spoke at one point about how he had planted a blueprint in the ether for the development of the work of his mission of self-realization for the world. Self-realization fellowship has made it seem as if that blueprint were detailed instructions. Swamiji says the blueprint that Master planted in the ether is a vibration of a certain ray of divine grace that through this line of Master's has been offered to the world. And the way Swami described it is Master never decided in advance what he would impose upon the world, but his phrase was he responded to every opportunity that seemed consistent with that vibration. It's a very subtle way of thinking. And all through Swamiji's life, I noticed when people would come to him with projects or when opportunities would come, and they could be as diverse as starting a magazine, a one faith magazine, or buying opals in Australia that he would then sell in the United States. I mean, you would look at those two things and you would sort of wonder where the business plan was in all of that. But whenever he saw an opportunity that he thought in one way or another would further Master's work, if he felt it was consistent with the unique ray of grace that Master had entrusted to him. That whole issue of the unique ray of grace is very interesting. Hearing the singers this morning, as we always do, the people chanting and then singing, we'll hear more singing before the day is over. At many different times over the course of his years, Swamiji would make different comments about the role of the music in the total mission of Ananda. And he talked about how the vibration of the music would keep us all in tune. He very interestingly spoke that in the early Christian era, when they all sang their Gregorian chants, and the monks and nuns would come back to the monasteries or live in the monasteries, and every day they would sing those Gregorian chants, Swamiji commented that those chants were the exact vibration of what they were trying to accomplish spiritually, both in themselves and in the world. And in some way that you would have to have intuition to understand, singing those chants kept them in tune with what they were trying to do. And gradually over time, the practice of singing those chants began to wane, and it could be argued that the spirit of the work also shifted more into institutional and dogma ways of thinking rather than communion. Well, all through Swamiji's life, he was always writing music. And in fact, he said all his life, melodies would come to him, and they would come to him in such, you know, in such a quantity that he paid little attention to them. And it wasn't until he was starting a work on his own, and the way the story actually went, he was camping in Yosemite in the early 60s, after he had been expelled from SRF and hadn't yet started Ananda and didn't really know what he was going to do with his life. But he'd always been a very good singer. Different people had tried to persuade him that he could make a lot of money singing, which he said was not a real great incentive for him, but others thought it would be. But he was in Yosemite, and somebody just sitting, you know, on the ground under a tree playing the guitar, and he felt like singing, and he sat down and sort of joined them impromptu. And he'd been living in India. He'd been living in a monastery. He knew all of Master's chants. He knew many Indian bhajans. But he's in Yosemite and some young guys are playing the guitar. It wasn't really a time to sing Tarama, Tarama, or whatever he was going to sing, or the Puccini opera arias that he had learned. So he said he sang Sing Low, Sweet Chariot, and it was a great hit. But after that, he was sort of out of music. He just didn't know what to do after that. But he observed how, what a beautiful thing it was to share music with people. And he thought to himself, how wonderful this would be, but what can I sing? And then it came in, and he was looking for his, he was looking for Master's guidance as to what he was supposed to do with his life. And he said, in that moment, he said, maybe I could write my own songs. And he said, in that moment, the song Farther Away Than the Stars came to him, which is a deep mystical love song to Divine Mother. He said the words, melody, everything just came into his head. And from that point on, he began to write a great deal of music. By the end of his life, he'd written over 400 pieces of music and all the lyrics for many of them. Not all of them had lyrics. But he talked about that music in many different ways. Once he said that after Yogananda died, his successor, Rajasi Janakananda, his most advanced male disciple, who was an American man, James J. Lynn, with that name that Master gave him, that Master, during his lifetime, often said to Swami, you have a great work to do. And after Master died, Rajasi said to Swamiji, you have a great work to do, and Master will give you the power to do it, the strength to do it, the power to do it. He used several different words. Once I was sitting next to Swamiji, I believe it was during an oratorio concert, and he wasn't singing, he was in the audience, and I was sitting in the audience also. And somewhere in the break in the music, he leaned over and said to me, when Rajasi spoke of Master giving me the power to do the work, he was referring to this music. Isn't that interesting? That the power was this music. It would come through, and what it would do is it would articulate in a non-intellectual way, in a way that was vibrational, and we would experience what we were trying to do. I mean, it's very interesting. And the implications of it, I don't know. You know, I feel like these are things that will just unfold themselves very slowly. On another occasion, he said, he says, this music is not my music. It's not our music. He said, it is a new consciousness coming into the world as music. Now, isn't that an interesting way to think of it? Because we're living in this extraordinarily interesting transition between a lower and a higher age. And, you know, these transitions, that this is the history of the planet on a much larger scale than just what you learn in the 10th and the 12th grade, where they just pick some little tiny fragment out of it. This is the principle of ascending and descending ages on the whole planet. You know, the Bronze Age, the Iron Age, the Golden Age, the Yugas, it's called in India. There's a wonderful book called The Yugas, which is in our bookshop, and I urge you to get it. It's fascinating. But we are transitioning from the age of matter to the age of energy, from a darker age of form and dogma and external definition of reality to a higher age where energy, and ultimately consciousness, but not quite yet, where energy defines things. Our whole age is characterized by this ever-increasing capacity to manifest more and more subtle forms of energy. You know, it's sort of a joke, but, you know, a computer used to be, you know, rooms and rooms full of it. Somebody told me that the computers that, you know, were involved in the first space launches were less powerful than the little watches people wear. I mean, think about that. What that is, that exemplifies the transition between matter as reality, even just the thought that in order for something to be powerful, it has to be really, really big, right? It has to be big, it has to be heavy. And then gradually we understand that things that are just, you know, almost literally invisible to the naked eye can have more power than the greatest force here. What we're doing is we're moving and understanding matter and spirit are beginning to come together. That the power of the spirit is where the real energy is coming from. And everyone who is powerful in this world, even people who are powerfully evil, in some way or another, have captured the fact that you can be a channel for this power. And people who are evil, it's not very good karma for them. But sometimes people who are evil are more advanced than people, as Swami said, who are too lazy to sin. It's not really that they're good, it's just they don't have enough energy to manifest anything that they want. There's a story, I don't know if apocryphal, but nonetheless it's an interesting one. Swami Vivekananda, who was the disciple of Sri Ramakrishna, some man came up to him very limply and said, you know, can you help me to realize God? And Vivekananda, who was a powerful man, said to the man, can you lie? And he said, lie? I would never tell a lie. He said, can you steal? He said, I would never steal. And Vivekananda said to him, supposedly, well, my first assignment to you is you must learn to lie so effectively no one can tell. And you must steal so skillfully that no one ever catches you. When you have accomplished that, you may come back and I'll talk to you about God. Now, it's just a ridiculous story. You don't know where to put it in your mind. But the truth, if it was truth, at least the principle behind it was simply this. This was not a good man. He didn't have energy to be good. He didn't have energy at all. And whatever tiny energy he might have was for evil. But he needed to at least get some energy going. He needed to be doing something, to be proactive in his life, to have experience, to find out the consequences of different ways of behaving. And then once that was happening, then it could be refined. Swamiji always said he would rather work, you know, sometimes Swamiji would take on people. If there were people at Ananda who were just impossible for anyone else to work with, he would always work with them directly. I believe I was exhibit A of that. Very early on, he just swept me into his aura because I really do not think I could have functioned anywhere else. And I wasn't the only one. And, you know, he kept me pretty close most of his life, so I'm just not really going to comment any further. There it is. But I had energy. That I did have. Energy bouncing off the walls in all directions. But there was something to work with. It's very interesting in the tradition of yoga practice, Master teaching us Kriya Yoga, bringing to America the science of Kriya Yoga. It's a very important fact that he did not in any way invent it. Babaji did not invent Kriya Yoga. In fact, it was essentially in the darker ages, it just became more of a secret because most people were not interested and there was too much evil in the world to have that power widely distributed. But then as the age began to elevate, as it tells an autobiography of a yogi, Lahiri Mahashaya went to the Himalayas and Babaji initiated him and Lahiri brought it back into society as a whole and eventually Master brought it to the West. But nowhere in there did Master invent it. It was an ancient technique, is an ancient technique. He said every great spiritual teacher in all of creation sooner or later comes to and teaches something like it. Because we are made in a certain way. The kundalini energy rises through the spine. The chakras are the concentrated points of energy. Energy has to be interiorized and elevated. The breath and the mind and that energy are all interconnected. Nobody can invent it. Even though all the things that we give people credit for inventing and getting patents and so on like that, people are just perceiving what is possible and then reassembling it in a new way. That's all. It's all there to be discovered. Nobody goes out and makes it. They just figure out how to utilize and apply it by divine inspiration. So most of what Master teaches, concentrating on the breath, listening to the inner sounds, working with the inner energy. But Master did create, now he created out of what was already there, one original technique, and that is the energization exercises. And many of you, I know, because I know many of you, already know what these are, but it's about a 12-minute collection of 32 exercises that uses the power of the mind, the body, and the concentration. It looks a little bit like calisthenics, but it isn't. And it looks a little bit like yoga postures, but it isn't. What it's doing is teaching us that the true reality of our entire being, and by extension of the entire planet, is the capacity to tune into energy, to manifest that energy, to direct, to control that energy just by the power of the will. Because once you have that, then you have the keys to the kingdom. Everything, the most successful people in the world, what they have learned to do is they have learned to concentrate and to manifest and to channel energy. That's what they're doing. And every great spiritual teacher in the world is just filled with energy. Swami Kriyananda, I mean, that was the characteristic up to the end of his life. I remember being at his home one evening, Crystal Hermitage. This was when I still lived at the village. It was like maybe 11 o'clock at night, 12 o'clock at night. There were 16 people in his house, I counted. And each one of them was engaged in some project that he had created and assigned to them. You know, somebody was doing slides, somebody was repairing a building, someone else was over here doing a painting, people were working on his books, just in every direction, just keeping this whole, well, everything that we're experiencing here, concentrating, directing, uplifting, and manifesting energy. That's the age that we're moving into. That's what we're about. That's why Vivekananda said to this man, realizing God, you know, God is power and energy. And we don't get there by being passive. We get there by putting our concentration out, doing our best, absolutely trying as hard as we can. I had to learn that from Swamiji. He was so energetic. I remember one night, this was when before the Crystal Hermitage was modified as it was. Right now, for those of you who know it, you go downstairs into the lower level, and there's a closet on the left. That closet used to be his meditation room because there was only one floor. And somebody had the idea that you could insulate it for sound by getting a lot of those cardboard egg cartons, you know, where you get two dozen egg cartons that are flat. So he had put all these egg cartons up on the wall, but he said he could feel all those points. And even when he was meditating, all those points were not harmonious. So he tried it for a while, and then one evening he just decided this was the night it had to be changed. So Seva and Swami and I, we ripped all of that out, and then we cut all the styrofoam and we put it up on the walls, and I believe we hung blue curtains or something like that. We worked at it, you know, like from dinner time till 3 in the morning. And I say we. I mean, he put his mind to it and he did not stop. It didn't matter what time it was, nothing mattered. This was going to be done. We were going to do this energy. And we did, just whoom, like that. And I thought, whoa, this is what it means to work. You know, as Hari Das wrote, he in 1973, Swamiji took a group of singers down to Los Angeles to make a recording. This was one of the first times. We didn't have our own recording studio. Somebody offered him the free use of one, which was a huge amount of money that Ananda didn't have at all. So the free recording studio was a great boon. So he took a dozen people down to Los Angeles. I wasn't one of them. I only heard about this afterwards. And they all stayed in one house because nobody could afford hotels. Swami had a private room and everybody else was just sleeping everywhere. You know, one bathroom shared by 15 people. Just everybody managed fine. Swami, as Hari Das says, Swami woke everybody up in the morning to meditate together. Then they go off to the studio for hours and hours. When they weren't doing that, he would hand them stacks of books and send them out in cars to sell his books all over Los Angeles. Hari Das, in his humorous way, said, "I believed in the path of moderation," he said. I thought I could just kind of ease my way into God realization. But Swamiji showed him absolutely not. You know, the power that you see in the universe, we have to be that power. Hari Das said, Swami never stopped. He said often they were just flaked out on the floor of the studio, just sound asleep. But Swami, who was 25 years older than anybody, just never stopped. You know, that's what we're trying to do. Now, our reading today is very simple. First things first. It's like, what are we doing? Where are we going? What are we trying to accomplish? How are we going to get there? It's a very important question. And there's the thing about self-realization is because it's about our consciousness, it's not a question of meeting some external standard, checking off the boxes. We're doing a project to get accreditation for our high school, because by the time children are trying to go to college, the accreditation matters. Actually, otherwise, I don't think we'd bother, because we know what we're doing. We don't need other people to tell us. So I have this 19 pages of questions that are just about as convoluted and as impossible as they could be. Because I don't know why, but they're just like, whenever people make forms, they try to make them really hard to understand. You know, but the more I keep looking at it, I realize they're just asking me, what are we doing? And I know what we're doing, and I can tell them what we're doing. We're taking care of children, we're providing them real education, and we know how to do it, and we're delivering it. You know, all of this form, that plan, this outcome, this measurement, this, you know. No, we know what we're doing. We love those children. We know how to take care of them. You know, we have to always bring our life experience down to a very simple question, because self-realization is about consciousness. Is there any time when you are not existing in a state of consciousness? Is there any moment when you can separate yourself out from your project of self-realization? Well, this is why there's so few who are trying, because it's a big job, and it is an inescapable job. People ask Swamiji, have asked him at different times, you know, how do you succeed on the spiritual path? How do you keep from quitting? How do you stick with it? Among other things, he said very simply, you have to realize it's a matter of life or death. It's not optional. And it's not that you necessarily start there. I don't mean to frighten anyone by saying that. You don't necessarily start there, but sooner or later, it crosses your mind that all I ever have is my consciousness. All I'm ever experiencing is my consciousness. I can have this huge story about who did what to me and when they did it and the impact that it made on me, and I'm not mocking that. It's all extremely true. Very traumatic things happen to us in this life and previous lives, you know, and to the people around us. This is a weird world. It's just like super weird. You know, Swami puts it humorously today in our prayer, you know, help me enjoy the comedy of this world, you know, the tragic comedy, because then I realize that the only lasting truth is in God. And so sooner or later, we have to figure out that all of these efforts to just make it work in some other way, isn't there an exception? My father was a Virgo. I didn't know astrology when I was growing up. Only later when I learned, which is how much I know, is about an inch worth of it. But I realized, oh, my father was a Virgo, and he was such a Virgo. My. He was a very intellectual man, very, very intelligent, and he liked to really analyze things down, and he liked to see if there was any little exception somewhere. He was always just pushing like this. It was very sweet, and I've just put this in. He was a very dear person. It was sort of an annoying habit, but he was a dear person. When he, in the last 2 years of his life, I don't know exactly what happened, but almost in one afternoon, his mental functioning shifted radically, declined radically. But the most interesting thing happened. He forgot what he was worried about. And he became so sweet. He forgot that he had to be the Virgo always analyzing everything. And he just remembered that he was just a dear, loving, wonderful man. You know, so sometimes that which you think is like negative, it wasn't negative at all. He was so sweet. He'd always been sweet, but he became really sweet when his mind stopped tormenting him. So sooner or later on the spiritual path, we realize that all we have is our consciousness. And whether we're happy or sad or cheerful or energetic or depressed or angry or feeling mistreated or anything, where does it happen? It happens inside our head, doesn't it? And there's remarkable stories about people in terrible circumstances who still, inside their head, are having a completely different experience. And that's all that self-realization is. Self-realization is our inner reality. And at some point in our the soul's long journey from darkness into light, that point really becomes the main reality. And then we understand what Jesus said, seek ye first the kingdom of God. And then everything else will follow from that. Now don't misunderstand, that doesn't mean that you'll get all the stuff you want. And it certainly doesn't mean that your karma will end. Swamiji's original dome used to leak. It just leaked like a sieve. I've mentioned this to you before. There was a trap door that led down under the house where the firewood would store. That house leaked so much that we would literally lift the trap door and sweep the water out like that. It was just horrible. And they put plastic coating over it. They repainted it. They did this, they did that. And no matter what, the thing leaked because it had been sprayed on foam. This was all, you know, in the early 70s, we were experimenting. Spray on foam, which expanded and contracted in the temperature change. So it was continually cracking itself. So no matter how many times you fixed it, the temperature would change and it would just move and then it would crack again. And at some point, Swami sort of said like this beseechingly, you know, but Lord, I'm so sincere. I'm so sincere. I'm trying so hard to make it stop leaking. He often would joke about attitudes that we would be inclined to have seriously. Lord, I'm so sincere. Why can't you fulfill my desires? Why can't you give me what I want? Why can't you make my life easier and nicer? Why can't you make it so that I don't have to put out quite so much energy? Because that's what it always comes down to, isn't it? It always comes down to whether I can concentrate sufficiently to generate the energy to face the realities that I have to face and keep going with the integrity that the spiritual path demands. And we, you know, God is our divine mother. She gets it. She understands. We just can't always do it. When I was 7, I went to sleepaway camp. And I was the youngest kid in the camp. I loved it. It was great fun. But I was just too little for a lot of stuff that was happening. And we had to weave these potholders. You know, they had, who else went to day camp? Did people go to day camp anymore? No, they go to space camp and, you know. But anyway, so we had this little wooden thing and had all these little nails and you had all these little elastic things and you had to weave it together like that. And I just couldn't do it. And my little hands couldn't figure it out. So when parent visiting day came and every other child had potholders hanging on their bunks, I didn't have any. But the kid sleeping above me did. So I just took a few of hers and put them down on mine like this, you know, because I just couldn't do it. And of course, she wasn't real pleased because they were hers. And so there was, you know, I don't remember the altercation, but somehow or another, something happened. And I don't know why my parents didn't condemn me for lying, because they were pretty strict about that, but I said, they fell. I remember just trying to persuade my parents that I didn't take them, they fell. But what I remember most of all was that my mother understood, and I just remember my mother holding me. And I was just sobbing. It was so tragic, you know, as these things can be. But what I remember most of all was that. Now, I was fortunate because I had a mother who would do that for me. Maybe not everyone has that, but we all have a divine mother who does that for us. And that's the important point. Even if we fail and we say, they fell, it wasn't my fault, I'm so sincere, she just says, that's all right. She waits until we get ourselves organized again to say, seek ye first the kingdom of God. I will muster the energy. I will find a way God will give me the power. I will listen to the music. I will practice the Kriya at least as much as I can or want to, because I know all I have is my consciousness. And what will it serve me to compromise that? And it will serve me in every way not to. That's what Jesus wants us to know, and let us do our best to remember. God bless you.